You're listening to Movie Sucktastic.
A bizarre, senseless, and likely to be sensationalized murder took place last night. The body of its victim, Mrs. Harry B. Howler, a widow, was found in this sour-smelling garbage container behind Sweeney's Buffet in Slackmore Flats just after 6 p.m.
I know it. It all sounds like some bad movie.
Oh man, where you been? Welcome back.
I've been stockpiling, motherfucker.
Oh yeah.
I don't know why I almost said composting. That makes no sense at all. But hello, sir. Welcome back to Movie Sucktastic.
Well, hello to you.
Oh, okay.
Hello to you.
I'm Scott. That's... Yeah. I'm Scott. That's Joey. And we're going to dive right in by reviewing the 1990s?
1992
film, The Vagrant.
Yes. A film I had no idea existed.
This is the kind of stuff I was This is the kind of stuff I was watching religiously in the 90s. I would rent video, like two videos a night, and yeah, just but, I had a problem.
But how did I miss this? That's the thing.
Huh?
How did I miss it? Like this is something that was probably on Cinemax all the time.
Possibly,
you know.
I mean, I remember reading about it in the, you know, horror magazines I read at the time.
Was this in Fangoria? Whether
it
was Toxic,
it might have been Fangoria, Toxic Horror. Who knows?
Because I tell you,
it's possible.
I mean, The Dark Backward. Yeah, I knew about that one all day, all night. You know,
mm-hmm.
Judd Nelson, Bill Paxton. I knew it. Bill Paxton was doing some weirder stuff in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this film, not on my radar, not one bit.
So what'd you think of it?
I actually liked it a lot.
Look at what's there not to like.
I know.
You know.
And another surprising fact, produced by Mel Brooks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. True.
You know, so I don't know how they were able to get that, but Mel Brooks, you know, he's done some. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't know that he produced The Elephant Man as well. So it's an interesting film to have seen Mel Brooks' name on.
You know? Well, and he's not the only one. I mean, the director, Chris Wales, well-known special effects artist, and they let him, after he did such a great job, I think on The Fly, they let him direct The Fly too.
Oh, I didn't look up the director. Oh, okay. You're getting worse. I'm getting better. And
but yeah, he had a special effects background, which makes sense because for the few deaths we get in the film, there's some pretty good special effects, practical effects in here.
Yeah. Oh yeah, actually, yeah. And I texted Scott the night I watched it, and I'm like, all I'm seeing and hearing is Father Jack from Father Ted.
Yeah.
That's it. Now, Father Ted came out after this, right? I think a year or two after this. And I'm like, did Father Ted, was Father Jack inspired by this guy? Because, I mean, even down to like the bad eye. Because Father Jack's got a fucked up eye, too.
Well, I guess we should set up the film. I mean, just do the walkthrough thing, the talk about it. It starts off with a nice feels like Brazil opening in the office space.
Yes.
Which, considering their budget, that has to be a real office space somewhere.
Oh, I would doubt
it. They didn't build that set just for this shot for this low budget film.
No.
So they shot on a real office. So that adds a level of queasiness to those shots when it's going over. It's like, Jesus, that is going on forever. But Bill Paxton plays a young Bill Paxton, plays Graham Krakowski. He's a number cruncher at a business. They're kind of vague on what he does. He just does, you know, computer stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And
or accounting stuff.
Right. And his boss is, I can never remember his name, but I always remembered him in that
TV. Stuart Pankin.
Yes. He was, I always remembered her from that sketch comedy show on HBO.
Yep.
What was it? It was Not Necessarily the News.
Not Necessarily the News,
yeah.
Correct.
I loved that show growing up.
I remember watching that. Yeah, I was probably a bit too young for the political humor. That's kind of where I started watching political humor was there. That was my first exposure to it, I think. But yeah, I always recognize him from that as well.
That show,
definitely.
And you know, when we did Cube, I texted Scott. I'm like, oh, the Wren. He was in a TV show, a sketch comedy show called Bizarre, which was on Showtime, and it was the first appearance of Super Dave Osborne. And I remember watching that when I was a kid, and that one actually had full frontal nudity and everything, and that was on Showtime. So it's interesting that back-to-back podcasts have people from sketch comedy shows that we grew up watching in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of recognizable faces in this film, too. I mean, Marshall Bell, which you can't recognize as the vagrant because of the horribly gruesome effects makeup they have on his face. It's really disgusting. Beautiful job. And then his best friend is Mark McClure, a.k.a. Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen from Superman, yep. And Back to the Future.
Yeah. And I like how Mark McClure's character sticks with Bill Paxton through all the hardships.
Yeah, like they're at lunch, and he's like, I think I might have killed her. And he's like, whoa, dude. take it down a notch.
He was at the funeral with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of felt bad that he was left out of the third act.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Colleen Camp, she's the horny real estate agent.
Oh, right.
She's been in a ton of stuff. I can't even nail her now.
She was in Police Academy 2. She was a love interest for Tackleberry. Yeah, she was a love interest for Tackleberry. She was, she was even in Wayne's World in the early, the same year, actually. Yeah, I think Wayne's World came out the same year as this. So, yeah, she was always kind of like a little typecast as a sex kitten a bit. You know?
I can agree with that. I can agree with that, definitely.
I mean, as she got older, she had a few more serious roles and whatnot, but actually, she's still with us? I don't know.
Oh, everybody's dying. I can't look that up. And of course, Michael Ironside as
the detective.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised he didn't get top billing over Bill Paxton. I didn't think Bill Paxton was that big of a name in 92.
Well, yeah.
I mean, they give him top billing now because it's Bill Paxton.
Right.
But,
and both Michael Ironside and Marshall Bell worked together on Total Recall. Just a mere couple of years earlier.
Yeah. So they're used to working on a budget.
Colleen Camp is still with us.
Oh, that's good.
I like that.
Yeah, so Bill Paxton plays Krakowski, and he's this business guy in an office. You know, he's a very milquetoasty, very meek, mild-mannered, and he decides to buy a house.
I love when he's looking at the real estate, and it's like $70,000, $90,000, $50,000.
I knew you were going to comment on that. I made Holly watch it, and I'm just
like, what the fuck?
I mean, Holly watched it. I turned to her and said, no, he's going to spend at least 5 minutes on these prices. You know?
well, now I'm not, but I had to at least point it out.
Oh, no, definitely. Definitely.
And he's just
talking about how
he can't afford them. And I'm like, oh, my fucking God.
And it takes place in New Mexico, right?
Was it New Mexico?
Pretty sure it was New Mexico.
Yeah, I was getting a Southwest vibe from it. I wasn't 100% sure. If it was,
it could have been
out the outskirts of LA for all intents and purposes. But does it say? Go ahead.
So when he buys the house, when he buys the house, it comes with a vagrant that was in the house when he first got it, and then later turns up camping outside across the street.
Yeah,
so he starts becoming obsessed with this vagrant, and weird things start happening, and he starts thinking he's hallucinating. He also finds this book in the house that turns out to be written by the vagrant. I know I'm jumping ahead on the spoiler with that, but I mean...
That's okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, and what I like about the film is that... So the whole first act is him buying the home, and then the vagrant, and he meets his girlfriend, and the vagrant's there, and he's obsessed with him, and he's scared of him, and the vagrant's like, it seems like he's taunting him, but they're leaving it enough open. Like, first act, they leave it open that he's just imagining everything.
Yeah, that he's just kind of going nuts on his own.
So second act, the girlfriend leaves, and the attacks ramp up, people start dying, and the cops start getting involved. And by the end of the second act, he's accused of all these murders that the vagrant's been performing around town, which leads to, I think, the funniest moment in the entire film.
Which is?
Which is when his mother dies on the witness stand in court. It's got to, I mean, it's just, this film, I undersold it. I undersold the comedy part when because I hadn't seen it in a while. So when I challenged it to you so many weeks ago, I remember saying, it's not that much of a comedy. No, it's a comedy.
It's a dark comedy. Yeah, I was actually talking to somebody about it tonight. I was talking to someone about it tonight. They asked me what I was reviewing, and I told them all about it. And they said, is it like a horror film? I go, no, it's a dark comedy. I go, that's absolutely the direction that it goes.
So the filming location
for this was Phoenix, Arizona, in Scottsdale.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't know if that's where it takes place, if they say that, or if they say New Mexico, but it's definitely right in the vicinity. It's right there.
Yeah. They hit the dead mother with three beats. Not only does she die, but then they start, like, they do, like, the violent CPR on the... Right. While all the cameras are going off, and then right after that, when they're bringing, they drop the corpse outside of the courthouse. I mean, I shouldn't find that hilarious, but I think that was one of my favorite parts of the film.
No, I thought it was funny.
But what I really like about the film is that the third act just takes off and decides to do its own thing.
It really does. It kind of, All right, so when he's accused of killing the old lady, and when he goes to court, and that's when his mother dies, he actually wins the case, and he's found not guilty. So what does he do? He ends up in a trailer park.
Yeah, he's like, I lost everything. You know what? I'm going to go manage a trailer park in the middle of nowhere. He's like, wham. And then it's like, you know,
the third act starts right there.
Yeah, then it's like doodly doodly doodly, like I guess like 2 months later, 3 months later, something like that. Something. Enough for him to bleach his hair. I don't know.
Are hitting on him, and you know,
stuff. Oh, Dodie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I like the Dodie character. I thought that was a bit overkill, but that's me. You did notice all the Coca-Cola placement in this film, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely, I did.
You can't swing a dead real estate agent without hitting a Coca-Cola bottle in this damn film. Or the sign, or the can. Well,
you know, and it's funny. I was reading that this film only was released in 8 theaters, and it made $5,900 total. $4,300 in its opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really did not... You know, they didn't trust this film at all.
It was direct to video. The 90s was a perfect time for these kind of films, direct to video. They knew that going in, usually, that they could at least get a video distribution. It sounds like the theatrical release was more of like the, you know, like the East Coast, West Coast premieres. Okay, we're going to show it opening night, opening weekend in like these two cities, and that's it.
Yeah. But.
Yeah,
it did hit theaters. It did at least do that.
It counts.
They they didn't care, unfortunately.
Now, what about this? Now, the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you're the one who usually like raves about the soundtracks, but I loved the soundtrack. I thought it was great.
I did like the soundtrack for this.
Very low rent. You can tell it's done on like broken bottles and plastic things and crap, and then you have the little wind up music box tune that signals the vagrant, like whenever the vagrant's around or like there's the threat of him is there. That's you hear that music in the background. I thought it was very effective on a small budget.
I thought this film felt bigger than its production. You know, I thought because it was remastered by Shout Factory or Scream Factory, or they're owned by the same company, but it was remastered by them. And I just thought the remaster was really nice and clear, and they just really good job on this. And
yeah,
everything. It kind of reminded me when we saw the remaster for
Street Trash.
Street Trash. Yeah, and it was like, we probably don't deserve a remaster this nice, but I'm glad we have it because I love the film. Same with this. The remaster for this reminded me of when we got Street Trash.
Yeah,
which I haven't bothered to watch the remake. I don't.
Because I guarantee, I guarantee, when I saw this, it was on like a 14-inch TV screen off a VHS tape. So I definitely did not see the best quality of this when I first saw it.
Well, this is my.
No, I know what my setup was back then.
My first iteration of it, and I watched it on a 75-inch 4K television. It was glorious. Loved it.
Yeah. Also, I should have mentioned the screenwriter real quick. The other film he's known for, as far as I'm concerned, is the film Scarecrows from 1988.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He wrote that too, which I always thought was a superb cult classic that doesn't get enough credit.
I remember we did, what was it? It was a while ago. I don't remember what episode it was. But we did a remakes episode where we talked. Mm-hmm. We had our own list of films that we felt should be remade in some way. And I brought up Scarecrows. And I remember even way back then, it's like, you know what? I think Scarecrows, that would be a good remake. Every time I think about it, I said, I wouldn't mind a Scarecrows remake. Let's do that.
Yeah.
I mean, we got Clown in the Woods or Clown in the Cornfield, you know?
I saw that on your Plex. What are you doing?
Well, it's from the same director that did, what the fuck? He did this. He did another horror movie that was actually pretty good. So I was giving it a chance.
I don't know. That's the kind of stuff I put on my Plex.
I watched the first few minutes of it. It's a real movie and a real production. So it's not like... It's not like one of those like super shitty, super low budget films that where the plot is bad and dialogue is really kind of corny. It's at least in the first 5 minutes that I watched, it looked like a real effort was being made. That's what it looked like to me. So, we lost Scott. Oh, you're back.
Here.
We lost you for a second.
Yeah, I lost you too. I don't know what happened there.
No, okay. I didn't go anywhere.
we don't start with me on that.
Still got to run a hard line in your house.
What my number one rule these days is I've got to have a trailer to watch before I go downloading, unless it sounds very bizarre, because I just don't have the patience for. Ultra low budgets anymore, unless it's unique,
right?
You know, and you can tell from a trailer. Yeah, you can just tell from a trailer if it, you know what the level of the you know, it's like Thanksgiving. You know, it's like the bad acting and horrible quality, but it's so bizarre, you got to give it a shot. But it's got to be that Thanksgiving level of bizarreness for me to supersede that nonsense,
right? So. The director of this is the guy that directed Tucker and Dale vs. Evil.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That's why I gave it a shot.
Fair enough.
His name is Eli Craig. So I was like, fair enough. All right. He did Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. I love that movie. I'll give it a shot.
I heard they're doing a sequel.
Really?
Yeah, I know. I was like, just enjoy the moment. Do we need, and let it go.
Do we need a sequel? We don't need a sequel.
Apparently, that's all we need.
Oh, God damn it.
Yeah, Michael Ironside. So he kind of walks through the film, but it's a different than when Steven Seagal walks through a film, because when Steven Seagal walks through a film, he doesn't really try. Michael Ironside is emoting at top volume, even though he's not really trying.
Oh, I know, especially the end scene.
Yeah, I have no, like when he's in the diner, like just talking smack to this waitress for no reason. I have no problem believing that that's how he is in real life, because he pulls it off so smoothly. I would have no problem buying that. I don't think he is, but if someone told me that, I'd be, oh no, yeah, that makes sense.
From what I understand, Michael Ironside is a fucking teddy bear, because he plays all these like bad people, you know, like these characters where, you know, in Scanners, he's blowing your head up, but it's like in Total Recall, he's a fucking maniac going after Schwarzenegger. From what I understand, he's a fucking teddy bear.
however teddy bear he is, he augers it in to Sharon Stone in that movie.
Yes.
Yeah. He buries that tongue. He buries that. Yeah. Very unfortunate. That poor girl. But he's great in this. I mean, Bill Paxton puts in a lot of physical comedy in this. You got that young artist is ready to do anything, and he's just risking injuries but bouncing over tables and walls and stuff. At the end when the vagrant frames him for more murders at the trailer park, and he runs off and he ends up at that little tourist trap.
Right.
Best name for a tourist trap ever.
Oh, I don't remember.
John Stillborn's.
Oh, God, that's right.
John Stillborn's.
Oh, so I'm looking at his mugshot. You had a screenshot of his mugshot. It does say the state of Arizona. So it was filmed in Arizona, and it takes place in Arizona.
All right. Yeah, you knew it was
probably cheaper
around that area.
It was probably cheaper to just make the movie take place in the state that you filmed. There's probably some red tape. If you're like, oh, we filmed in Arizona, but it takes place in New Mexico. I'm sure there's red tape with that. It's like, you know what? It takes place here. Fuck it.
And you know what? Sometimes that gets the help of the local film commission. The state film commission will help you out on that probably. Sometimes. You know, yeah. It's like, oh, you know, because it promotes filmmaking in the state, and they want that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I worked with the New York City, the New Jersey Film Commission for a while. That's how I got my job initially in the industry. So that was fun.
You know, we're getting here in Jersey, we're getting a Netflix filming studio. It's going to cost like $4 billion. It's only going to be like 45 minutes from my house, maybe less.
Oh man, Netflix is becoming a force of nature.
Yeah, and their movie studio is going to be based here in New Jersey, over in. Ocean County, I think. Yeah, something like that. It's only 45 minutes from here, from my house.
I wish they weren't as focused on like making new stuff as they should be, and like preserving old stuff and making it all available. I mean, you think that would be a good shtick? I don't know.
Well. They dole this shit out slowly because they want to make money for as long as they can.
Yeah. So
I mean, look at Disney with the Star Wars, the theatrical cuts of Star Wars. They still haven't released them.
Yeah.
They haven't. Lucas doesn't own them anymore. We don't have to be force-fed to special edition shit. They can release the theatrical, but they won't. And my theory is the 50th anniversary is in 2 years. They'll release the original cut.
I can see that
theatrical for the 50th, and then in 3 years when Empire has its 50th, they'll do the same thing there, and then in 3 years when Jedi has its 50th, they'll do that. So over a 9-year period, you'll get all three films and their theatrical cuts slowly. They're not going to do it all at the same time. They'll do it slowly. They'll have it premiere on their Disney Plus streaming app. They'll have it you know, on Blu-ray and 4K Blu-ray and all that shit. And you'll get to theatrical cuts. But my gut is they're going to wait till the 50th anniversary in 2 years to start.
Makes perfect sense.
That's what I think.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I'll give you that one.
We'll see.
Makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, now, special effects, I got to point out the one that kind of threw Holly off, too, was the fridge, the refrigerator, when they find the real estate agent's head all wired up and stuff. I love that shot. That's the shot I have on my Plex when you open it up. That's a great screen. That's a great special effect there. I mean, it looks really good.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of reminded me. Oh, what was that one movie where you opened the fridge and it was body parts in it? Fuck, I can't think of it.
Name one. I mean, yeah, I know. I know. Chainsaw. Not Voices.
No, I was thinking of that, but that's a newer film. It was an older film.
Oh.
It was like an 80s movie, and you open it up. You opened up the fridge, and there was like a head, and I forget. Oh, maybe it was Creepshow. Maybe I'm thinking of birthday.
Or Saturday the 14th.
Maybe Saturday the 14th. Maybe I was thinking of that. Yep.
Yep.
But, yeah, no. And so when he finally confronts the homeless guy, the vagrant, and he's telling him about how everything that he's achieved is because of him, and you find out that he's an author of a book that was in the house the whole time, which he looked at, but didn't look at the back cover, which has the picture of the author. When he was
the back cover, when he finds it, the back cover's torn off.
Oh, I thought the back cover, like the book, no, was found later.
He finds another copy in the vagrant's steamer chunk.
Oh,
that's he finds cool. More copies there, but the copy he finds in the house initially is missing a back cover, which is kind of a film red flags. Okay, this is gonna be important later. But that's important too, because in the second act, he's reading that book and actually he convinces himself by reading the book that he's gone insane and it's not actually happening.
Right.
That he's like hallucinating, sleepwalking, imagining things, and that he might be dangerous. And so it's funny that, and then at the end, it's revealed that the vagrant's been doing this whole thing as an experiment on him to begin with, because he's actually a failed psychologist who lost his job for doing crazy shit like this.
Yeah. Like at one point he tells him, you're famous because of me. You're interesting. Yeah. You know,
you're an interesting guy now.
Everything you have is because of me.
Look at you. You got an interesting style. You got an interesting story. I can't thank you enough. Yeah. We get to see the wild eyed, Bill Paxton that will become very popular later on.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, this movie is only, 4 years removed from Near Dark, and only 6 years removed from Aliens, you know?
I mean, Near Dark, there's another one. Talk about a film to just get involved in, like a low-budget horror film, but then it's like, oh, yeah, now I'm a part of like cult film history.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he managed to pick some of the right interesting films to work on, and you could just tell he was an interesting guy.
And that was what's her face too. She won Best Picture for The Hurt Locker. She wrote and directed Near Dark. Mm-hmm. She dated James Cameron for a little while.
Yeah.
The fuck was her name? Jesus Christ! I'm getting worse with this. You know, like I could tell you in a second who it was.
It's just a woman. Don't worry about it.
Oh, wow.
Wow. I said that in case we had any female audience, because that'll take care of that toot suite, won't it?
Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah.
Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah, that's right. Catherine Bigelow. Yeah. Love The Hurt Locker. Great film.
Yes. Yes. Great
film. I don't like war films. Yeah.
Although I think that year, I think Inglourious Basterds probably should have won Best Picture that year, but mm-hmm. I like The Hurt Locker enough that, you know, I was okay with Hurt Locker winning, even though I felt Inglourious Basterds was the better movie. My oldest son, he's 15 now, and he keeps he keeps coming to me and says, "Hey, can we watch this? Can we watch this? Can we watch this?" And they're all within the realm of, you know, it's like, okay, we could watch that. It's R rated, but you're 15. He's actually pretty mature for film, for cinema. I was actually pretty surprised at how mature he is for cinema. He like really enjoys it, and that's what makes it easy to say yes, I think. You know, in a couple of years, he could be able to watch anything he wants anyway. He's not going to have to even have my approval.
Yeah, right?
You know? But he is asking if he can watch certain things, and I think about it. I'm like, okay, we can watch that. I like to rewatch a lot of this stuff too, you know? Unlike him, I can hold back and not give things away. He's 15. I have to tell him all the time. I go, pretend I'm in a movie theater. You're sitting next to me and you don't know me. That's how I have to do it. And then he's like, oh, okay. I go, because if you really were in a movie theater and you're talking during the film next to a person you don't know, you might get smacked in the mouth. People are crazy. I go, pretend we're in a movie theater and that you're sitting next to me and that you don't fucking know me. Just some random person. And then we're good. We get it.
All right. Anyway. So this is on the list. He can watch this?
Oh, he could definitely watch this.
I would say
this is a soft R. You know, even the one scene where it's a real quick scene where he's having a bad dream and he's banging his girlfriend.
And the vagrant's got her bent over. Father Jack. Yeah.
Girls.
Yeah. The dream sequences, like, and I also like the dream sequences because they blurred that line on whether or not he was actually imagining the vagrant or not.
Right.
So I thought in this film that the dream sequences worked. It wasn't played out, you know, like in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you know, they actually make sense.
No, I like this film a lot. So do we want to rate this thing?
Well, it's got a 5.8 on IMDb.
5.8. Okay.
Probably too low.
It is too low. Now, here's the thing. I don't know if this is a 7.
No, it's not a 7.
This is because when you start heading in the direction of movies that are 7s, I mean, you're heading into like almost Best Picture territory. You know, there's a lot of films that are in the 7s that are Best Picture,
or at least honorable mention. Like, oh yeah, you know, good, but could have been better. But I kind of agree with you. 7 is that hard line. Once you cross 7, you're talking about decent cinema, and it's a great. I enjoy this film immensely. But I'm with you. I think 6 is the highest we can go on it.
Yeah, I mean, we can't do half points. We can't do half points, but this is a film I would go like a 6.5, you know, or a 6.7 if we could get that detailed. I would go there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I would go. But yeah, 6, I'm good with a 6.
Yeah.
I think 6 will work just fine.
Oh, okay.
So.
Now,
yeah.
What do you want to watch next?
Well, I got The Wheel. Scott, Scott updated The Wheel, which I have right here.
I took off a bunch of the best Oscar films because I was like, "Let's all right." It was a noble idea, but a flawed one. So I got rid of that crap.
Okay.
So we're not reviewing any Oscar films unless it's Oscar time. And you know what? I'm gonna have a talk about that because I think we should do the Razzies this year instead.
Wait, not review any Oscar films at all? Do Razzies?
That's my proposal. And okay.
Whole reason we do Oscar films because it gives us an opportunity to watch good films or movies that are perceived to be the best of the year.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole reason we do it. It's not gimmicky, but it's also an excuse to not watch perceived tripe.
I'm just playing with the idea of changing pace a bit, but okay. That's just, I'm just laying the seeds now.
All right. We got a lot of time for that, but okay. So now I have the wheel on the screen. What it's just word salad vomit. I mean, that's the best way
I can describe this.
It's just shit everywhere. You can't make out a single film because there's so many on here. So, all right. I'm ready to spin this. You ready?
Oh, well, I'm
before we waiting. Do this, as we always explain, both Scott and I have one veto each. Okay? So, yep. We could both use the one veto, and then on the third spin, if it gets to that, we have to review what's there. All right, let's do this. All right, here we go.
God. Some juicy.
Slowing down. Big money. Oh, fuck me.
What?
You have the Twilight franchise.
Yes, I do.
And I'm vetoing it.
Oh, you bastard.
Sorry. I'm not doing it. I've made it this far and this long without watching a single one of these fucking movies.
I'll get you yet.
Sure you will.
I've seen all of them except the last two. And I'm not watching those unless we're watching them together.
Oh, God. Oh, all right. Spinning one more time. Maybe I've seen this. Fatal Games.
Yes, this is.
Games.
Yeah, I don't have my.
I don't know this.
My keyboard is all.
Hold on, I'm looking it up right now. 1984, Sally Kirkland.
Yes.
Directed by Michael Elliott. Athletes at a sports academy are getting systematically killed by a mysterious javelin thrower.
What? It's a straight-up slasher. Straight-up slasher, buddy.
Oh, man. Well, that was the time period when they were churning those out.
Oh, yeah. And this is one of the ones they churned.
All right. So
we get to churn with it.
Any veto from you, or are we doing Fatal Games?
Hell no. I think that's a great idea.
All right. Let's do it. Michael Elliott is known for just Fatal Games. That's it.
Even better.
He directed Fatal Games, and he wrote it as well, but then he wrote To Kill a Stranger, which also came out in 1984. And then he didn't do anything ever again. Wow. So that either A, he's like, you know, fuck this shit. I don't want to do this. Or B, get the fuck out. You're never allowed to do this again.
Who let you in?
Yeah. It's one of those two things. Wow.
Well, since you had never heard of the film until it came up, I don't think it's going to be... I think lack of quality is to be expected.
Okay.
I think we can.
All right. Fatal Games it is.
They should have called it The Javelin.
The Javelin. Actually, here, let me check out real quick. Came out in the United States in 1984. It's also known as. There's 15. It's like different. In the United Kingdom, it was called The Killing Touch.
Ooh.
In Spain,
I like that.
Olimpiada de la Muerte. What is that? Death Olympics? I think that's Death Olympics in Spanish. But as far as any other like names, it's pretty much. Oh, in Europe, it was called Olympic Nightmare. And Fatal Games is the most common in other languages. Interesting. The Death Olympics.
I think it's a good role. I'm happy with it.
The Killing Touch. Killer Spiel. In West Germany, it's called Killer Spiel.
Killer Spiel.
Killer Spiel. Norway. Spike Skisternen.
Italy, so he's a javelin.
In Italy, it's Giochi Fatali, which is Fatal Games in Italian, by the way.
Okay.
Anyhow. All right, let's go ahead and end the show here.
All right.
All right, baby. Yeah, let's do this.
Do your thing.
I'm going to do my thing. All right, man. Thank you for joining us again, as always. Episode 448 of Movie Sucktastic. You can go to our website at moviesucktastic.com. You can listen to the show right from the website. Download the show right from the website to PC or phone or whatever listening device you have. Take it on the go. You can click on the YouTube link and it'll take you to YouTube to watch the video that we just created reviewing this film. You can go to iTunes and you can listen to the show there as well. You go to Facebook.com and you Facebook.com/MovieSucktastic and you see everything that we're posting there. You can also leave us email. The address is themovieguys@MovieSucktastic.com. If you want to leave us voicemail, it's 908-514-4470. Scott has a Letterboxd account, letterboxd.com/MovieSucktastic. You can check out all of that. Podcast player, moviesucktastic.com/mst.apk, or you can just download your favorite podcast player and do a search for Movie Sucktastic. Every episode is in there. This also goes for Amazon, not just iTunes, Amazon. We have iHeartRadio, Spotify now, everything. Just do a search for Movie Sucktastic in your favorite browser. Do you have any words of wisdom, Mr. Wilson?
I'm getting better.
I love that scene. It's such a good scene.
It's a good movie.
I do agree with that. We should review that. Is that in the list? In the wheel?
No.
That dog scene, though. That dog scene kills me every time.
That's part two.
That is part two. That's the line that he did. I'm getting better.
No, that's from part one.
No, it's not. Oh, wait a minute. No. It's in both movies.
Okay.
It's in both movies. Eric Stoltz is, Seth is son. Seth Brundlefly. Seth Brundle. He's his son. He does the same line with Daphne Zuniga in the hotel.
Yeah, you did. You obviously didn't recognize my Brundlefly impression, that's all.
Well, no, I thought you were doing the line from the second film because the director of this movie did the second film. Whatever, it's fine. You know what? It's all good. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you next week when we review Fatal Games.
Fatal Games.
Olimpiada del Muerte.
Yeah, Javelin.
All right, everybody. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.